I'm going to be talking about symmetry-enriched topological phases. This is joint work with Nate Lindner and Alexei Katayev. And there's also some related work, which I put up here, by people who partially scooped this. So I'm going to be talking about gapped phases of quantum many-body interacting systems in various dimensions, but primarily in two dimensions. And the story is going to involve these concepts these two concepts of symmetry and topological order. So, let me go through the basic story that one usually gives when one talks about symmetry. So, the basic idea is that there's this Ginzburg-Landau classification of phases, quantum many-body phases with a certain symmetry. Different phases are distinguished with using local order parameters. And the standard story goes that, some phases do not have local order parameters, and there's this concept of topological order. So certain gap phases cannot be distinguished with local order parameters, but they can be distinguished using sort of these exotic properties. Like, for example, they have anions with exotic braiding statistics and all these other properties. Okay, so you can either have this Ginzburg-Landau classification order or topological order. Now, obviously, that's not really the whole story, since topological order a priori doesn't require any symmetry, right? If you have a gapped topologically ordered phase, it's actually stable to any perturbation. Okay, so there's no symmetry requirement. So really, what one would like to do to go beyond this Ginzburg-Landau classification is to consider gapped Hamiltonians. I know that Ginzburg-Landau doesn't necessarily require gapped Hamiltonians, but I'm going to restrict myself to gapped Hamiltonians. So we're going to consider gapped Hamiltonians with symmetry and no local order parameters, okay? And see what kind of phases we can have that are not distinguishable with local order parameters. Okay, so in the past few years there's been a flurry of activity in this subject. So there's prominent experimental examples of phases which first of all are not conventionally ordered. Second, they do not have any topological order in the sense of having like exotic anions or exotic braiding statistics, but nevertheless they're distinct from trivial phases. So, for example, the quantum spin Hall effect is distinct. The quantum spin Hall phase is distinct from a trivial insulator, and that distinction is protected by time reversal symmetry, and similarly for a 3D topological insulator. So that's just experimentally. Also, theoretically, there's sort of been a slew of theoretical models proposed, actually exactly solvable models, which realize phases, for example, in two dimensions, which don't have anions, do not have topological order. They have a symmetry. The symmetry is not spontaneously broken, and the phases are all distinct. Okay, so these are these so-called symmetry-protected topological phases. Okay, so the basic question that I'm going to be addressing in this talk is, how do you distinguish phases that have both topological order and symmetry? Okay, so the basic idea is that there's actually already, I mentioned this stuff with symmetry protected topological phases. There's actually a pretty good, so first of all, I'm going to restrict myself to two dimensions. So in two dimensions, there's actually a fairly good classification of symmetry protected topological phases. So gapped phases with a symmetry and no topological order, okay? Generically, if you take a gapped Hamiltonian in two dimensions, it generically might have some topological order. It might correspond to a phase that does have topological order. So, if you take a generic gapped Hamiltonian with symmetry, you would like to be able to classify those phases, okay? So somehow extend this symmetry-protected classification to the case where your gapped Hamiltonian realizes phase with anions with topological order, okay? So here I just listed the various properties of the systems we're going to be looking at. One important thing is that we're going to be looking at systems with bosonic degrees of freedom, okay? So no underlying fermions. So morally speaking, your system is basically some kind of a system of spins. Like I said, two-dimensional, and the symmetry group that we're going to take, just for convenience, is we're going to be looking at finite, so discrete abelian, discrete groups, and we're also going to take abelian groups just for convenience. you know, we believe that this can be generalized, but this is just for convenience to make the story simple. And also, just for illustrative purposes, I'll also consider translations in some cases. Okay, so one important concept that we're going to need is this idea of projective representations of the symmetry group G. Okay, and so basically, the physical idea is that in a topologically ordered phase, you can have roughly the idea is that in your underlying microscopic system, you have some degrees of freedom, and because you have a symmetry G, those degrees of freedom form ordinary representations of that symmetry G. But if you have if you have now a Hamiltonian for that microscopic Hilbert space, and that Hamiltonian realizes some topological phase with emergent deconfined excitations, those deconfined excitations could carry in some sense fractionalized quantum numbers of G. And in the precise sense, making this concept of fractionalization precise requires this notion of projective representation of your group G. So there's a sort of contrast between ordinary representation and projective representation. So ordinary representation roughly corresponds to ordinary quantum numbers. And mathematically, an ordinary representation is, if you have a group and some group elements, an ordinary representation is just some choice of matrices that obey the same relations as the group elements do. Okay? By contrast, a projective representation sort of relaxes that requirement a little bit. And again, you have some matrices that represent your group, but they only have to obey the group relations up to a phase. Okay? So there's this phase, phi, as a function of your group element GH, which is sort of the mismatch between the left side and the right side of this equation. So somehow all the data of a projective representation is actually encoded in this function phi of two group elements that tells you about the phase mismatch. Okay, and so this is pretty abstract. This is a pretty abstract notion, so it's good to have a concrete example in mind. And actually, one really good concrete example is symmetry of G is the group of SO3 rotations in three-dimensional space. So for this group, you have ordinary representations, and you understand those very well. They're just ordinary integer spin representations. But then you actually also have projective representations, and these turn out to be, there's only one class of projective representation, it turns out, and these are the integer plus 1/2 spin representations. Okay, so why are these projective according to this definition? Well, it's because let's look at a spin 1/2. In a spin 1/2 representation of SO3, if you look at the rotations by 180 degrees around the x, y, and z axes, those are represented by the poly spin matrices, x, y, and z poly spin matrices. And the spatial rotations, 180 degree spatial rotations around x, y, and z all commute in SO3. They just commute. But the poly spin matrices anti-commute, so there's this extra sign here, which is a phase. So somehow these guys are projective representations, and these guys are ordinary representations. Okay. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
When you say integer plus half, you mean it could be integers n half, right?
I just mean like 1/2, 3/2, 5/2.
So integer would always be regular.
Yeah, integer would always be
right. From the projective.
Yeah. There's a group structure on that. Right. So I have some slightly technical slide of the various properties of projective representations. So all the data in a projective representation is encoded in this function phi of two group elements. And I'm not going to go through these properties, too carefully. But the main point is that somehow, you might look at this function phi and think there's a lot of information in there and it's just sort of hard to wrap your head around. But in fact, these functions phi form a very, very constrained structure. Okay, so for one thing, there's this gauge transformation where you can sort of redefine your matrices U, G, U, H, whatever by a phase, and that sort of changes phi. So phi has a certain gauge transformation property. And there's also, it turns out, a constraint. You can't just choose any function phi here. It turns out there's a constraint that comes from associativity of the underlying group. Okay, so the entire structure is rather constrained. And actually, if a good physically intuitive way of thinking about it, and this is just purely an analogy, is that you think of these structures sort of an analogy to gauge fields, like U1 gauge fields on some surface of non-trivial topology. Let's say U1 gauge fields on a torus. Okay, so you know a priori, if you look at U1 gauge fields on a torus, there's lots of them. You can write down any gauge field you want, if you impose a constraint, which is that let's say the curvature vanishes, so you're looking at flat connections, and then you impose gauge invariance, so you're looking at only gauge invariant observables. Then if you look at flat connections on a torus, those are actually parametrized by only two pieces of gauge invariant data, which is the holonomy of the gauge field around the two cycles of the torus. So just integrate the gauge field around the two cycles. So somehow this seemingly huge amount of information gets reduced down to a finite amount, and the same thing happens here actually. For a finite group, it turns out there's only finitely many classes of projective representations. Okay. And there's some mathematical terminology for these classes, and it's called group cohomology, and that's group cohomology group H2. That's not really important. Let me talk a little bit about how this idea of projective representations applies to classifying phases with topological order and symmetries. And so roughly the idea is that deconfined excitations in your topologically ordered phase can become projective representations of your symmetry. Okay, so in an ordinary non-topological phase, somehow you have this notion that all excitations can be made with local operators, and local operators are made out of the underlying spin degrees of freedom. Those are all honest representations of your symmetry. So somehow excitations just carry ordinary representations, ordinary charges of your symmetry. But what can happen in a topological phase is that you can have these deconfined anionic excitations, these anions, that cannot be created locally. So if I want to create an anion, I actually have to make it with a string operator that the string operator will create my anion here, but it'll also create the antiparticle somewhere perhaps far away. Okay? And so while the whole string operator transforms into an honest representation of the group G, if you break up that action into sort of, because everywhere, the system is gapped everywhere, and somehow the string is condensed, and so you can't really tell where it is. So it seems natural that you could break up this global action of G on this pair to some local action on the left side and some local action on the right side, UG left and UG right. And the point is that even though the total action satisfies the group relations, just the local action on this side only needs to satisfy the group relations up to a phase. Okay, and that phase is canceled when you also take into account the right side and look at the product. So that's how these kinds of phases that define projective representations come in these two-dimensional systems. Okay, they're associated to anions in two dimensions. So that's all fine and good, but there's something I glossed over here, which is how do you actually define a local action of your group on a single anion, like. How do you actually act just on this side and not on this side? I mean, you could try to do something dumb, which is like, act on just the spins inside this red circle. Just act with the symmetry just on those spins. But obviously, that doesn't commute with the Hamiltonian, on the boundary on this red boundary, right? So you can't do that. So how do you define a local action of your symmetry G? Well, it turns out there is a way to define it. And it's a little involved, but basically the idea is that you use the idea of an adiabatic continuation. So it's a four-step process. So I want to act on this anion here, but not on this guy, with a symmetry G. So the first thing I do is I nucleate a defect anti-defect pair. Okay. So this is actually some modification of the Hamiltonian. So you have a defect connected to an anti-defect through a branch cut. So the branch cut's an actual modification of the Hamiltonian. You're changing the Hamiltonian across this branch cut in such a way that basically going across the branch cut is just like acting with the symmetry G. So for example, if it was translation symmetry, I would have nucleated a pair of dislocations, and I would have changed the couplings from sort of going directly horizontal to like going like this. So that corresponds to a single translation downwards. So first thing, I nucleate defect anti-defect pair, then I move one of the defects all the way around my anion in the process growing this branch cut. And so this is some path in Hamiltonian space. I'm deforming the Hamiltonian. And remember, I want to define an action on state. So I have a path in Hamiltonian space, but I can adiabatically follow the state that I'm interested in acting upon as I do this process. Okay? So third step, I go all the way around, and that annihilates the defect. So then I get some state using this adiabatic continuation. And that state's an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian with a branch cut all the way around here. Okay? So as a final step, I can now actually act purely with it on that state, purely with G, purely on the spins inside here, and that does and that takes that state to an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian without the branch cut. Okay? So somehow by doing this whole process, it allowed me to you know locally act in this region. And in the process of doing so, I also, in particular, act on just this anion, but not on this anion with my symmetry G. And that defines my local action. Okay? So there's a lot of subtleties involved in this kind of process. Rather than explaining them in detail, let me just illustrate this on an example. So the example is sort of everybody's favorite example of an exactly solved topological phase, which is just a toric coat or Z2 spin liquid. Okay, so this is the usual Hamiltonian for the toric code, but I want to look at a deformed version of the toric code. The deformed version has the same Hamiltonian; it has the vertex terms and it has the plaquette terms, but there's a different sign than the usual sign for the plaquette terms. So I switch the signs of the plaquette terms. So basically, the Hamiltonian favors like occupying each plaquette with a magnetic charge. But this Hamiltonian is still exactly solvable, so. It's all good. You can write down the ground state, and my symmetry group is going to be spatial translation, so integer cross integer, spatial translations in x and y, generators tx and ty. And it turns out that in this case, the electric Z2 electric charge will be a projective representation of this symmetry. So to see that, you want to get some intuition for what the ground state is for the deformed toric code. So in an ordinary toric code, the ground state is just a superposition of all loop configurations with equal amplitudes, just a coherent superposition. That's what the ground state looks like. It's just these loops sort of condensed, fluctuating in all directions. The deformed toric code, because it has that sign switch in the Hamiltonian, it's actually, the ground state is a coherent superposition of loop configurations, but there's an extra sign, -1 to the area of all the loops in a given loop configuration. And this sign is there basically so that if two loop configurations differ only by a single plaquette, the corresponding amplitude differs by a minus sign. Okay, that just comes from the fact that the sign of this term, the Hamiltonian, the plaquette term, was switched. Okay, so somehow it's still the loops are all condensed, but there's these extra minus signs sort of encoded in the thing. Okay, and so why is the electric charge projective under this Z cross Z symmetry, the translation cross translation symmetry? Well, roughly the idea is that, look, if you start with two electric charges, so there's this one here and there's this guy here, and I want to act just on this guy, first I want to act by moving it left and then up, and then I want to act by moving right and up and then left. Well, the state I started with was made with some string operator connecting these guys. After I act with my symmetry, basically if I first go left and then up, I get a state that's created by the blue string operator, okay? Because somehow, I shifted everything to the left and then I went up. If I do it the other way, I get a state that's created by the purple string operator, okay? And these two string operators, they create the same state. They have the same endpoints, but they differ by a single plaquette, and therefore the states that they make differ by a sign, okay? So you see that, I accomplished the action, whether I go left up or up left, those two generators give me the same state, but only up to a minus sign. Okay, and that's a projective representation. So again, this is a slightly technical slide, basically saying that this idea that I just illustrated in this example actually generalizes quite well to any anion system. Okay, so if you have any set of anions, which I've labeled by A here, you can sort of get phases that encode the projective representation types of those anions, okay? And those phases are somewhat constrained. For example, if two anions A and B fuse into a different anion C, then there's a constraint on the corresponding phases. But the whole thing somehow forms a coherent mathematical structure. That mathematicians have understood. Yeah.
So Well, the previous example.
Yeah.
That was supposed to be an example of the group carrying out the transformation, right?
Yeah.
That's
right. The group is translations.
The group is translations.
Yeah. Exactly. So.
There's a flux in the. Is there a flux in that state?
Is there a?
I didn't catch what the ground state would be.
The ground state you think of as a superposition of all loop configurations, but if you have two different loop configurations that differ by a plaquette, you get a minus sign. So there's some minus signs that come in the amplitudes. And particularly these two states differ by a minus sign. That was just one particular example. Like I said, the thing generalizes. And in particular, you know, if you want something sort of more intuitive, I mean, the most natural group symmetry group to look at in some sense is U1, charge conservation. I said I wanted to deal with fractional with finite groups, so but I can still look at like a sort of a poor man's version of U1, which is the discrete group Zn. If n is large, this is kind of like a discrete version of U1. And it turns out that with this group Zn, you can also have anions transforming projectively under this group. And basically the idea is that anions can bind fractional charges of the Zn. Okay, so that serves the different types of fractional charges that anions can bind kind of serves as a hallmark of the phase that you're in. And you can, yeah.
Actually, Lucas, I had a question about the previous slide, which is probably by now too late. So the string in principle, if you just put two conditions, the string is invisible, right? It's a figment of your imagination. So does this statement mean that there is some kind of destructive interference going on, that the amplitude of this state is going to be suppressed because of the different signs coming from?
No, I mean, all the states are super, coherent superpositions of lots of different string amplitudes. And both of these configurations exist in both states, no matter which way you act. It's just that in each state, they have to exist with a relative minus sign. Okay, so if I act with this string operator.
So it's a statement about destructive interference somehow between these different.
Okay, I don't understand that very well. Maybe we can talk about it after I talk. Okay.
Sorry, another phase. Sure. Is it obvious that so is the phase that you brought up in the example, is it different from a toric cause topologically or not?
It's not. Topologically it's not. It's only distinguished from a toric code using because of the symmetry.
Okay.
If I can break the symmetry, it's the same phase. And that's my goal, to classify topological
symmetry.
Okay. So let me just go on. So we've defined one way of distinguishing topological phases, which is, you know, given two phases that have the same anions, you can distinguish them by looking at how the anions carry different projective representation types of the symmetry, or different fractional charges, in other words. But now suppose that you have two phases that are both gapped and G-symmetric. They have the same anions, and the anions carry the same projective representation types. Okay, so the question is, no, are these two the same phase, or is there some finer way to discriminate between phases? And it turns out that there is actually a finer way to discriminate between phases, and this is because you can see this just because there exist symmetry protected phases in two dimensions, and these so there exist phases which don't even have anions, so sort of they automatically agree, they automatically carry the same projective representation types on their anions because they don't have any. But they're still distinct as phases, as symmetric phases. And so there's this mathematical classification, and there's this group cohomology that comes into it, and it's some very complicated math. The group cohomology is H3, which you might think is a function of three group variables, since H2 is a function of two group variables. I'm not going to get into like the details of the math, but I just want to say that this function of three group variables. That classifies SPTs actually has a very natural physical interpretation. So the physical interpretation is that even in an SPT, in a symmetry protected phase, even though you don't have anions, you can still make defects. So you can still puncture a hole and thread some flux of the symmetry. Okay, you'll get a branch cut, but that's fine. Okay, so you can still make defects, and it turns out that these defects bind fractional or projective charge. I'm using fractional and projective synonymously. They're not exactly the same, but I'm glossing over the distinction. And so the point is that the way that these defects bind these fractional charges of G, again, can sort of serve as a hallmark of the phase. And that's sort of naturally a function of three group variables, because, you know, there's two group variables as before that sort of correspond to the projective representation, and then there's a third group variable that sort of tells you what kind of flux you've threaded through the hole. Okay? So it's natural that a function of three group variables comes up. Okay?
So previously the projective representation was induced from the ground state, and now it is induced from excitation of the ground state?
Yeah, but I mean, so you're thinking of a defect as an excitation of the ground state. Yeah, but I mean, you know, previously we were looking at anions, so those are also excitations above the ground state. We were looking at sort of the fractional charges that they bind. Now I'm just saying defects can also bind fractional charges. And that's another hallmark, that even if you don't have anions, you can use that. If you do have anions, you can use both things. And the thing that I wanted to get to next is that it turns out that that's actually a complete set of data. Well, in some sense, it's a complete set of data. So if you know the projective representations, the types of the anions and the defects, it turns out that you have a lot of information. And I don't want to say that completely classifies the phase, but let me make a precise statement. You know, one other thing you can do is gauge your microscopic symmetry G. So in other words, just minimally coupled to some gauge field, and your global symmetry has become gauged. And so in addition to your original anions, you now also have deconfined charges and fluxes of the symmetry that you just gauged. So you have some enlarged theory that contains quasi-particles that are original anions, and then G-fluxes and G-charges, and sort of all possible combinations that you can make by binding those.
But some of the original anion will be changed.
Yeah. Wait, what do you mean?
Like when it goes around the G-flux, it...
Yes, yeah. So in the examples I've considered, so what I'm talking about so far, G doesn't permute the anion types, but this whole story actually does extend to the case where G does permute the anion types. But there you have to go through an extra stage where, you do have to consider it a little. Let me not talk about it further. Maybe we can talk about it one-on-one. So you have this enlarged theory, and then the claim is that these two things that we talked about, the projective types of the anions and the defects, are actually reflected in the fusion and braiding structure of this enlarged theory. Okay, so. So in particular, it turns out that the projective representations that the anions carry are actually encoded in the fusion rules of these deconfined G fluxes or defects. And roughly the idea is that look, if you go around, what does it mean for an anion to be a projective representation of G? It just means that if you go around with that anion, if you braid that anion around a pair of defects H and G, that's different from braiding around G and the composition GH, the defect corresponding to the composition GH, by a phase. And what actually happens is that when you fuse a G defect and an H defect in this enlarged theory, it turns out that what you get is a GH defect plus an extra abelian anion. Okay, so doing this braid is the same as doing this braid, which means that acting with G and then H is the same as acting with GH, plus as braiding your anion around this additional abelian anion, which gives you an extra phase. Okay, so the projective representation phase actually comes from the fact that when you fuse two defects, an extra abelian anion pops out, and that turns out to be a one-to-one correspondence. Furthermore, the projective types of the defects turn out to be encoded in the defect braiding rules, which is not that surprising if you think about the definition of local action that we had. If you do a local action of the symmetry on defects, you're kind of braiding defects, essentially. So that's not very surprising. But the nice thing is that there's a very powerful mathematical result, which is that any consistent theory for the fusion and braiding in this enlarged theory must come from some choice of these two invariants, the projective representation types of the anions and defects. Okay, so somehow these two invariants really classify all possible fusion braiding structures you can have when you gauge the symmetry. So it's fairly complete. However, you might want to ask the reverse question, which is, you know, so any consistent theory must come from some choice of projective representation types of anions and defects. But if I choose some, you know, if I conversely just choose some representation types for the anions and the defects, must that always lead to a consistent theory? And it turns out that the answer to that question is no. So it turns out that sometimes when you choose these representation type, these projective representation types, there's actually no consistent enlarged theory that's consistent with those representation types. And there's actually a fairly simple example of that. If you take an anion theory, one of the simplest anion theories possible, there's only a single anion, and it's a semion, single non-trivial anion. It's basically the nu equals 1/2 bosonic fractional quantum Hall effect. If you just take this theory and take the symmetry Z2 cross Z2 and demand that, remember, Z2 cross Z2 is sort of the discrete version of SO3, so the two Z2s correspond to 180 degree rotations around X and Z, and their composition corresponds to the 180 degree rotation around Y. If you take Z2 cross Z2 and you demand that the semion is a projective representation type of the Z2 cross Z2, in other words, a spin 1/2, that's sort of seemingly consistent with everything, but it turns out that there's no enlarged theory that you can construct, which means that this theory cannot be realized in two dimensions. Okay. However, the very interesting thing is that it can actually be realized at the surface of a three-dimensional symmetry protected phase, and this is sort of currently ongoing work with these people at Berkeley. And Minnesota, and it's really kind of nice. I mean, we actually have an exactly solvable model which realizes this theory with this symmetry in three dimensions. So again, you can generalize this to sort of arbitrary symmetry groups G and anion types A, and it turns out that sort of the general obstruction that you get, you know, if you sort of demand a certain choice of projective representation types for the anions and defects, the obstruction that you get is another cohomology theory, another cohomology class. It turns out it's in a one higher group, and these are the kinds of things that classify three dimensional SPD. So it seems like there's a connection between the math and the physics, which is quite nice. Okay, I'd like to end there. Thanks.
It doesn't have any topological order.
Yeah.
So you always have some sort of defect that carries a fractionalized degree.
Yeah.
So how is there a general way to construct, to understand what this defect is?
What do you mean to understand?
So maybe to what is it? It's a dislocation.
In a general SPT, you know, think of a spin system with on-site, let's say on-site symmetry G. So, so you just change the Hamiltonian along the branch cut in such a way that you conjugate the terms. Yeah. That's how you make defects.
Other questions?
Sorry, so, okay. Go ahead.
What is H4GU?
That's something that I purposely...
G is Z2 or something. It's a finite group, right?
Yeah, G is a finite group, correct.
Right,
yeah.
So... Can you
yeah. So
give
so so
specific
so
example?
So yeah. So
Z2,
something similar. Yeah yeah. So it's sort of defined by analogy with H2. So when the first thing that I defined projective representations, those were functions of two group variables valued in U1, and they sort of told you about the phase ambiguity. If you had two group elements G and H, the phase ambiguity between UGH and UGUH. That was a function of two group elements. These things are functions of four group elements. And they tell you about some much more complicated structure that sort of can't,
it's homology groups, right?
They
have nothing to do with homology groups.
No, they do. They do. They're called group cohomology groups, and they're defined in a very abstract way that seemingly has nothing to do with topology, but you can actually connect them with topology. So, for example, for Z2, like you mentioned, if I take Z2, and this works for any group. There's a corresponding topological space such that these things are the actual cohomology groups of that topological space. So for Z2, there's a corresponding topological space. It's called the classifying space of Z2, which is infinite real projective plane. And this is just the fourth cohomology group of the infinite real projective plane. So there's a top. I mean, I didn't talk about the topology because all these classifying spaces are infinite dimensional and very non-intuitive. But there is a topology behind all this.
I just have a very simple question. So the previous slide, what is the Z2 cross Z2 there? I missed that.
I mean, in our example, it's just some on-site global symmetry, on-site global Z2 cross Z2.
How does it act on this compound?
How does it act on?
On this.
Right. The semion is projective under the Z2 cross Z2. So in other words, these two Z2 generators anti-commute when acting on the semion. Just like the Torah code example, you know, with the semion theory. The Torah code example can be realized in 2D. This one can't.
Okay.